What goes up must come down, except maybe the Tic Tac. We've been talking about this, that case that sort of burst under global consciousness back in 2017. It remains a pretty a major important case. And the SCU, the folks here, my guest tonight, put together a massive report, an analysis of the Tic Tac case that is remarkably thorough, a couple hundred pages. You can find it and read it for free on the SCU website. We have links on the Coast to Coast page as well. Dr. Kevin Knuth, who's here with us, has done a lot of that analysis. I have one more question for him before he goes, and we're going to get into that. About it's about an outgrowth of the research into the Tic Tac incident, ongoing investigations in the area where it was seen. We'll have that story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Kevin Knuth, one more question for you before you go off to slumberland. And it's about, it relates from Tic Tac. So, you know, the problem with UFOs, you can never predict where you're going to, where they're going to pop up. At least not very, you can't predict it very well. But you are involved in a research project, Boots on the Ground, Catalina Island, where you and some colleagues are making ventures out there into that, those ocean waters to see what you can see. Is there, tell us about that a little bit. Is there an indication that UFOs, UAPs can be seen in an ongoing way in that area?
Yeah, certainly. Yes, I'm working with UAPX, which is was founded by Kevin Day and is now run by Gary Voorhees. And we are planning to spend time on Catalina Island and watch for UAPs and possibly hire research vessels to go out into the water to look for them as well. The Catalina Island is well known for a large number of UFO sightings, and the 2004 Nimitz encounter basically started with these things basically dropping down from about 80,000 feet just south of Catalina Island. So from that area, if there is continued activity, of course, it's 17 years later, so it's not clear that there's continued activity of Tic Tacs, but for maybe, but UFOs are quite commonly seen there. So it's really our best bet. You know, in some ways, you can think of it as a fishing expedition because we don't know where these things are going to show up next, and we have to learn where, you know, we have to learn about any patterns first. We have to study them first to learn about any patterns of occurrences. So this is how we're going to have to start.
And have you thought, considered that they seem to be interested in nuclear materials, nuclear?
Right. Yeah. So another option would be to go to, say, Malmstrom Air Force Base or nearby and monitor the skies nearby in that situation. So that's another possibility.
Kevin, I think you're about to leave us. I want to thank you for being here. We'll have you back sometime on your own, and we'll go into some details about the papers you've written. But thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and have a good evening.
All right. And Rich and Robert, I promised that we would sort of talk about the 2020 and what it has meant to this topic. Rich, starting with you, can you give me the highlights for you? What news broke this year that is encouraging to you about the future of investigation of this topic?
Well, I think for me, George, I mean, the year was pretty incredible, despite the fact that we had the COVID thing going on. The whole thing with the UIP task force was pretty exciting. Not that, you know, I expected that we're going to have suddenly disclosures or something like that, but the fact that Marco Rubio got that into the Intelligence Authorization Act for 2021 and it went through, that at least gives us a push forward and at least somebody looking into this subject seriously at the government level. And so I think that for me, that was a significant moment. I think there were a number of others, but I think that one for me stands out. You know, I'm just, you know, as well as I do, we've had, you know, political changes now. We've got it going from Marco Rubio leading the Intelligence Committee over to now you got Mark Warner, I believe, is going to be the lead for that. The hope is that there would be a continuance and a serious treatment of it. But there's just a lot of that, you know, funding and everything else that wasn't there for the task force. As we continue to uncover it, the expectations now are actually not as high as I was hoping for. But, you know, it's a step forward. And I, you know, over my 56 years, I've seen so many step forwards, but, you know, it didn't really amount to much. And I've been telling people to, you know, be very cautious about what your expectations are with this report. You know, we saw that with the Condon Committee report. We were expecting something excellent with that, and it didn't pan out. And then, you know, Gerald Ford had the congressional hearings about the swamp gas. That didn't pan out. You know, it didn't really make too much of a change. Then we had all these other kinds of, like, announcements and you know, events where we had, you know, people like, you know, all the Malmstrom operators, everybody getting together in the press club and being able to come out and say something. And the stuff that they came out with was rather incredible, but did it amount to much? Did it make any changes? And my response is it really didn't make too much change. I think I just like to make one thing real quick, George, that you made earlier when we were having the conversation, you were talking with Dr. Knuth. You know, and you asked him about, you know, has it changed for you to be able to talk about this? Has the stigma gone away? And, you know, and the stigma is still there. I mean, but it's at least now opening up a lot more discussion. And we started to see that with the growth of SDU. We've seen, and then and I work in the government, working with the Army. And, you know, and I've talked with Lou on many occasions. And, you know, and the hallway conversations have now opened up where people can talk about it, and it's not immediately dismissed and laughed at. So, I mean, I think all these things are pretty important to me, and I just want to share that.
Robert, the same question for you about the news that broke in 2020, what you found encouraging, what you found that's not so encouraging.
Well, I like Rich, I found the congressional request for a Department of Defense report on UAPs to be very encouraging. And then also, I think the Navy's admission that those objects, not only the one in 2004, but the recent ones in 2015, that they have no idea what those objects are. I was really very surprised that the Navy admitted that. So I found both of those encouraging.
Well, me too. Same thing is that, you know, the Navy is telling the public we don't know what they are, but they're also telling Congress behind closed doors we don't know what they are. They are truly unidentified. And a couple of people, including the new chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Warner, has have said that, you know, they've basically the only statements they made is, you know, we believe this is worthy of investigation. So they authorized this UAP task force to put together a comprehensive report for Congress due somewhere in June. And, you know, we were all kind of really anticipating something great. I broke a story a couple of weeks ago, information that I had learned about some changes there. You know, the Pentagon has always done the same thing. They've kneecapped these kinds of efforts before, and it looks like they've done the same thing to the UAP task force. They took the main guy out. They transferred him into some other job. He has, you know, from what I know, a great deal of experience with the subject, a vast information base in his head. He has a high rank. They took him out. They put a really capable person, from what I've heard, people who know him, who's put in charge of putting together this comprehensive report, but they give him no budget. They have no staff. In fact, this guy, I learned not long ago, has a full-time job. So he has to write this report for Congress on his own time. And it looks to me like they are purposely handcuffing the guy so that, you know, putting together a comprehensive report when he doesn't really have the clearance to get some of the most sensitive data, I think we should lower our expectations and hope for the best. However, you know, the ongoing interest by Congress, you got to hope that they would see what is produced and realize that, well, maybe they even learned in between now and when the report is due that the Pentagon has put some handcuffs on this and would make some inquiries and say, hey, we're serious about this. Put some resources into it.
I agree with you 100%. I think the only way that we can count on getting something of value out of that report is if there is a lot of pressure put on Congress by the American public. And that's what it's going to take. Otherwise, I can't see them coming out and stating there are things in the sky which our military can do nothing about. They're just not going to say that. So I think they will kind of do like you're saying.
Yeah, I think that there's so many other threats that will come to the forefront that the military has to deal with, as well as the politicians, by the way, with just all of the issues we have in the country right now going on. I mean, the attention is going to be on that. It's not going to be on the UAP stuff. I mean, there is one thing that they are focusing on, at least in the military world that I live in, and that is our efforts to put in what they call countermeasure, small UAS kinds of, electronic jamming and ability to be able to knock things like drones out of the sky. And we're installing those at our military bases where we have critical facilities. And the intent there is to be able to do this. Now, it's just shared with a number of others, the fact that the IEEE has put together a report on the part of the spectrum, and the spectrum concerns around that are that as commercial aircraft fly across some of our military facilities, with the electronic jamming that's going on, it's some of this is potentially impacting their GPS devices on board the aircraft, and commercial aircraft have had like over 90 reported cases where they've had problems and they lost their GPS aboard their aircraft, and that can throw an aircraft into a tizzy. So there's a lot of looking into that right now with the FAA, but ultimately we are attempting to install these because we perceive that there is a threat to our facilities. And I'm glad to see us doing it. And I think that stemmed from, if you remember those Colorado drones that were going on. And, I think we mentioned Palo Verde earlier, that there was a whole number of six drones that basically flew around the perimeter of the Palo Verde. And it was reported through, I think, either FBI or DHS, I can't remember offhand, that had happened. And and so there are these concerns, some of which could potentially be UAP. I mean, I'm saying that, not drones, but something else. And I think that there is now a focus to look at protecting our installations and our people in the facilities at those installations.
And you're working on that stuff, right? Are there the Huntsville facility where you are, they're working on this exact problem?
Yeah, for the Army, we're the lead organization in the effort for at least handling the Army installations that we're going to be placing this equipment. And it's pretty advanced. I mean, it's the ability, we've got the handheld gun, if you would, that could basically take over a drone and knock it out and kill it. But we've also got other kinds of equipment that we're installing to be able to help us do even more kind of like intelligence around these things, and to the point where, let's say you were off the post and not even around, and you're the operator, we would be able to identify you, the operator, where your location was, and come after you.
So, good.
The concern there is also going to be that, if you have autonomous drones that you don't have necessarily the remote kind of thing, then that's going to be even a bigger concern. So anyway, we're looking at that as a serious concern that we've got in the United States, and I'm glad to see that the military is addressing it.
Well, let me ask both of you about drones and unknown drones. So we've had, there's nitwits who fly their drones near airports, and there have been several problems that have been reported around the country and around the world. And then you got Jetpack Man, who's popped up in a couple of places, something different. But there are also some unknown drones. I mean, you got commercial drones flown by humans that are a problem. But some of the things that are described as drones making intrusions at sensitive locations might be something else. I mean, we don't know that the countermeasures that you're talking about are going to work against them. I'm speaking specifically about Guam. So a friend of mine dug up some information, had sources on Guam, which are very important base there, facilities there, listening post, that it was kept having these intrusions over really sensitive weapons storage areas. And there's, you know, Guam is pretty isolated. You're not like flying your drone from your backyard to go to Guam. This is where they were popping up at. It's a real mystery that these drones might be from somewhere else, that somebody else is flying them. So maybe, Rich, then Robert, you can address that and keep in mind that Colorado thing that you're talking about, because as far as I know, that has never been resolved.
Correct. It's not been resolved. And it's not like it was necessarily flying over a military base where we had even any equipment that we could do anything about it. You're absolutely correct in the sense that take a look at the whole nuke cases that were going on, right? I mean, we're talking about structured craft that are not drones that are over these military facilities. So you do have the mixture of that thing going on. And then plus you even have potentially natural phenomena. I mean, I'm talking about, like, if you've heard of earth lights before. I studied about an hour away from here. I had in Cloverdale, Alabama, we had a case since 1973 where a lot of residents in this area were seeing some things that were, they call them spook lights, and they would think, oh, there go the spook lights are moving across the farm out by the animals and stuff like that. But the point is, you have that kind of a natural phenomena that, you know, like the Marfa lights, and, you know, that in Norway and Hesseland, you have those kind of like, so you do have even those kind of like, you know, balls of whatever they are. I mean, we've done some sort of spectral looking at them and found out that they, you know, some of them we were able to deduce that had sulfur, oxygen, nitrogen, and, you know, maybe other elements like scandium and yttrium in it. And, you know, they're just like balls of gas that somehow ignite and move across the sky. And so even those could be potentially misidentified. So, I mean, you go back to a whole host of things that could be flying over military bases that we just can't, and we don't have any way of, you know, either investigating, identifying, and, yeah, the drone killers are not going to work on them.
Robert, do you have any information about the Guam case, the intrusions there by, quote, drones, and also same question about the Colorado drones?
Yeah, the Colorado drones, as far as I can tell, appear to be just typical, you know, whether they're commercial or military-grade drones, because they're not doing anything unusual that I'm aware of. However, in the case of Guam, I have the same thought that you do, which is that's a military base. It's isolated. It's a very small island. You have ocean all around. So I'm sure their first concern was, okay, is this a Russian or Chinese sub that has launched a drone out of the water into the area, right? But that's actually pretty straightforward for them to determine if that is the case. And if that was the case, I suspect we would never have heard about it. So I think it's unusual that we've heard about that case, and it would be nice to get some actual data on how fast were these drones moving, and, you know, in what direction did they go, and how far did they go before they disappeared.
I'll tell you what, maybe I can help you on that. We'll talk about that another time. We're talking with Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell from the SCU. Much more to come. We're talking with Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell from the SCU. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to dig deeper into some great investigations that SCU did, papers that they had written, in particular one from a case well-documented in Puerto Rico, fairly dramatic encounter, and we'll go back to a golden oldie of Stephenville, Texas. Pretty significant location for that UFO flap. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. I mentioned about a couple of the great papers, analyses that have been posted on the SCU website. One of the best is this Aguadilla, a Puerto Rico case, 2013. Robert, why don't you start that off, that discussion?
Yeah, sure. We received a copy of a video from Homeland Security back in 2014. Within 6 months of after it had been taken. Actually, it was late 2013. And when I first saw this video, it was just amazing. I mean, the beginning of the video, it's not that interesting. But then when you see this object go into the water without splashing, and then the real kicker is when it splits into two parts. And that was like, wow, I've never seen anything do this. And because there was lots of trees and other things in the background, we had the ability to actually determine the exact location of the object so that we could determine its speed and where it went. And it was an IR video, so we also could see heat sources. And I'll tell you, George, when I looked at it frame by frame, we broke each second into 30 frames. And when I saw the object double itself in size and then become two objects of equal size, that was amazing. And as to what that object is, you know, we have no idea, but there's no explanation for it as being a drone or a bird or a balloon or a Chinese lantern or anything like that.
What kind of official investigation was done?
Well, actually what happened was the Homeland Security guys, when they videoed this, they sent it to the U.S. Air Force, I believe to Quantico is where they were located. And 2 weeks later, the Air Force replied to them and said, we don't know what it is. Why don't you contact a UFO organization? Which is what a response. And so that's what the guys did. They contacted, a lady that one of them knew, and she knew Morgan Beale, and she got a hold of Morgan. Morgan got a hold of myself and the others on the team, and we began to analyze that video. We spent 1.5 years. We even got us all together and flew to Atlanta, Georgia to meet. Rich was there, I was there, Morgan Beale, a guy by the name of Larry Cates, and another gentleman who had formerly worked on nuclear Tomahawk fusion reactors, Carl. And I have to apologize, I don't recall Carl's last name at the moment, Rich May. Yeah. And so we all met in Atlanta and worked for 2 days on it. And then, of course, we also worked on it away from each other and just communicated via email.
Rich, any your thoughts on the Puerto Rico case, the significance of the case?
Well, I think let me put it to you this way. We all sat as we wrote this report. And we just kind of like sat for a moment after we got out, almost like finished in that hotel in Atlanta. And we were all just like dumbfounded. We were like saying, like, have any of you seen anything like this? I mean, have you ever heard of anything like this before? And none of us did. What you do is you know, in order to be able to get to the point like where you can identify it as being an unknown, you have to go through and identify it as a known. It's that the typical structure that even Hynek put in a long time ago that, you know, you need a de-escalation of hypotheses to get to that point. And so we were just dumbfounded. I think, you know, and I think Robert would agree, we were just like, we did a little video of each of us, you know, like, you know, maybe after we did that, and all of us were saying that we had never, ever seen anything like it before. And, you know, how often do you get kind of military-grade equipment kind of like footage, number one, and then the fact that you've got all that wonderful metadata that's all over the screen, that now gives you like GPS kind of coordinates and gives you their altitude and various other kinds of factors. And then to top it off, Robert did a great and fabulous job of being able to get the FOIAs out to be able to get like radar information and put that into a little simulated thing to find out that there was actually a radar contact, you know, that were just prior to that, right in that general vicinity. And that kind of substantiated to some extent the fact that there's this object that now seemingly is coming in over this airport. And then we were able to determine that the FedEx plane couldn't take off and it was delayed. And just all that stuff coming together, you know, and then looking at the weather that was going on, looking at the fact that it was a full moon on that particular evening, the fact that we were able to identify the type of camera that was used, that it was, you know, from a company called L3, and we were able to determine the model of it, and that helped us to get more information about it. It just came together extremely well, and we just have never seen anything like that, you know, and so we were thrilled to be able to put that together and treat it very seriously and scientifically, and I mean, the guys did a fabulous job of doing that. And so,
as I recall, I mean, you were able to say definitively, this is not a bird, it's not a balloon,
yeah,
this is not a drone, because none of those things can double in size. That's for one thing. None of those things split apart. As this thing split into two, and it entered the water and was traveling like 90 miles an hour underwater, right?
That's right.
You know, we determined the speed was a little over 100 miles an hour when it hit the water. Well, what, you know, you try to take a look at that in the context of, again, of what impacts would that be if it's hitting the water at that speed, you know? And then we tried to identify if there were any military drones that could hypothetically be in the air 1 minute and in the water. And we did find that there were some experimental kinds of things that were more like, when they went into the water, they were torpedoes. But guess what? They stayed under the water. They didn't come back out of the water. And so I think, you know, that's where we were at. It's a puzzle and it's a mystery. We never declared it was anything other than the fact that it's what it's not. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this, and we just don't know what it is.
Robert, you're going to add some details to that. I mean, it's splitting apart, doubling in size, traveling in water. That's a pretty strange craft. We'd like to have that technology.
Oh, yeah, and not only that, when it leaves the water, and it actually left the water, went back into the water and left a second time, the only type of drones we have now that can leave the water, other than something that's rocket-propelled, right, like an ICBM, when something leaves the water, it floats up, and then maybe a propeller comes on and it slowly goes up. Well, this thing came straight out of the water at high speed, so there was no floating to the top, and there was no rocket engine on it to propel it out of the water, because none of that showed up on the infrared video, because it would have been very easy to see any type of rocket heat that would have been generated.
We also had a clear expert, if you would, that we engaged, who actually had the same kind of camera and was able to you know, put that on like balloons and also birds and a variety of other things. And his name is David Falch, and he did a great job of being able to allow us to see that thermal signature and what it would look like. And it didn't match at all. And so, you know, when you take a look at that, you just like, well, you shake your head, because it doesn't match any of those things that we know of. And there was no indication of propulsion on the thing that, like, you typically think of, and the speeds that we measured, even taking the parallax into account, the speeds didn't match much at all. And the parts of the video clip that we did measure and look at the speeds were at the point when the plane was not doing its circling around the object, but actually was heading southeast, and almost got to the point where it was like 9 miles away from the airport. So anyway, it was a remarkable video clip. And I think that it was one of those ones where you saw science was actually attempting to do something, and we'd like to see that in every case, actually.
And Robert, is there any other case like that that you've investigated? Do you have anything even close to it?
That is the best video case that we've ever had. I consider it the best video case, and the Tic Tac case the best overall case because of the quality of the witnesses and the short video that was there. And then Stephenville is the best case in terms of radar data.
Well, we'll talk about Stephenville in a minute. Before we leave Tic Tac altogether, I mean, I agree. I think it, in this, essentially is the most important case ever because of the impact that it had. I mean, having the video and the statements from Dave Fravor and the and Kevin Day and some of the other personnel who saw glimpses of it or had closer encounters, the combined effect of all that evidence, the radar information, and then the sort of a secret report that was put together that analyzed the whole thing. Man, you think about it, there's few cases that are even close to as important as that. Because all that information is what sold the New York Times on putting the story on the front page and changing the UFO world forever.
Exactly. And I interviewed Lieutenant Commander Slate, who most people have not heard of him because he went on TV one time and then he stayed out of it and has stayed out since. But his testimony is just like Fravor's, very matter of fact. I mean, he was also a Naval Academy graduate. You got Naval Academy graduates that witnessed this from two different angles and two different altitudes. It's an amazing case.
I want to know if you guys could share with me your thoughts on, the U.S. Navy came out with this amazing statement. We want to make it easier for our pilots, for our service members to go ahead and report these things. We want this information. We want to encourage folks to come forward and tell us about it. Can you share with me whether that is actually happening, whether the Navy followed through by changing its regulations? And do you get a sense that pilots in particular are cooperating, or are they still wary about making these kinds of reports? And I'm asking that because I had heard that, off the East Coast where these encounters were happening on a regular basis off the coast of Virginia, that some of the pilots just stopped reporting it, even though they'd been asked to do so.
Yeah, I think the stigma is still there. I don't know how much the pilots actually believe that information is wanted. And additionally, there was, I don't recall who sent the FOIA, but requesting to see a copy of the new Navy guideline on that, and it was not released. So as far as I know, no one has seen yet the Navy document.
I think that some of the recent cases, like, you've heard about this the triangle that was coming out of the water.
Yes.
That, to me, that indicates that, and then there's that photo that was taken of some sort of an object that was outside of the plane, basically using probably their cell phone, which is just amazing. You're flying these high performance aircraft and then you're going to do that with a cell phone. But nevertheless, I think that there are some that are coming forward. I think that some of them are potentially, we don't know and haven't seen the video from the triangle that was allegedly coming out of the water. So I think that some of these things are potentially classified, and probably that's some of the ones that are going to be, in the classified aspect of the task force. But I believe that there are some, but like Robert, I think that it's going to be hard to change a culture, and the stigma around this thing is it's still probably there. And I keep asking, my question is what about the other services? Isn't the Air Force doing anything to look at this at all? And
Well, that's the amazing thing, Rich, is the Air Force has been silent through this entire thing. They've maintained their usual policy of never commenting on UAPs and UFOs.
Well, I think that they're still reeling from the bad taste they got in their mouth with the whole Project Blue Book thing, as well as, even the Roswell thing was kind of embarrassing. But you just don't hear the Air Force chiming in at all, and they're kind of like out there, but it seems interesting that the Navy, and of course this task force, is underneath the Navy in terms of its structure anyway. But you're absolutely right. And there's no nothing in the Army. I mean, the Army has got a lot of some of those military bases. There's nothing that says that I need to report that incursion into my military base per se that's being collected. So, yeah, we're not going to get anywhere if we don't get a full court press on this whole thing from a lot of the services being very active in engaging this thing.
We were talking earlier about the suggestion that Congress needs to know from the public, that needs to hear from the public, that this is an issue that isn't going away, that people are concerned about. I agree that people should put pressure on Congress because they can make the Pentagon cooperate on this and give a legitimate UAP task force report. But I almost feel guilty about, you look around at all that our country is facing right now, some really big problems. I care about the UAP issue, but I'm not sure I want it to take precedence over some of the other things that Congress had on its plate right now. Rich?
No, I completely agree with you. We just need to focus on, getting to some sort of sense of normalcy with everything from the COVID, with also the political mess that we're in, the divided country, the insurgents inside of our own country and terrorists, if you would. And I just think that, talking about UAP is just it's at the very bottom of the list. And I think a lot of the Congress people will probably pretty much go that same route as well. I think if we didn't have all this, maybe there's a potential. But I feel for, Chris Mellon and of course, Lou to be able to say that they're going to create the 2.0 version of this whole thing in this environment, because I think that's going to be extremely challenging to do.
Well, if anybody can do it, those guys can pull it off. I think that my sense from Lou and what I know about Chris is that is their focus right now, acting as sort of liaison between Pentagon and Congress and encouraging both to come forward and work on this and take it seriously. And they have good relationships back there, both of them. And if anybody can pull it off, I think they can. We're talking with Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell from SCU. Still to come, we're going to dig back into a golden oldie not that long ago, the Stephenville case involving presidential property, why it's important, and what Robert Powell learned. We'll come back after this